stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
It's the SanCan. It's El Tercero Corona. It's the Triple Crown. Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
You are the world champion!
Yes, good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whenever or wherever you are listening to this podcast, welcome to Motorsport 101. No, this is not, in fact, your friendly neighborhood host, Mr. Andre Harrison, because we have just learned that Andre Harrison has been disqualified from the podcast for excessive Snapple Flow violations. We take this very seriously, and as a result, Andre Harrison has been disqualified from the podcast. Dre's going to be back next week, though. So, for now, you have us from Chattanooga, Tennessee. I am RJ O'Connell, and folks, one of the great Le Mans traditions, because we're going to be talking a lot about the 24 Hours of Le Mans, is just, you know, going to the outdoors, hanging out, having beers, socializing, going out to cook. One great outdoor cooking hobby is barbecue. So naturally, we brought in somebody from the barbecue capital of the United States to, you know, discuss things of this nature. That's right. We brought in Ryan King from New York.
Yeah, I'm about to teach you Southern boys how to barbecue today. I learned from the best in Brooklyn.
Taking very much offense to this as our guest because after Dre's disqualification from the podcast podium, we've had to promote up to third place from Hooniverse and the DFL podcast, and now also for Motorsport101.com, Patrick Hofstetter.
There was a roundabout way that in the half of that intro for King, I was worried that there was no joke and you were just vamping and I was not cueing onto something. Then it wrapped all the way around and I'm like, I saw the Brooklyn thing coming and that was an affront to God. That was an affront to the ant. That animal should not have died for that barbecue. Are you kidding me? $20 for that. Are you kidding me, Brooklyn? Yeah. No, it's great to be here. The fuel flow rate is non-negotiable. RIP Daniel Ricciardo's Australia podium.
RIP Land Motorsports' chance of winning GTD at the Rolex 24. This podcast is going to go quicker than a Honda Power Red Bull. Yes, we're just dating this podcast, being recorded on the evening of June 18th, 2018. This is episode 146, and in it we're going to be talking a lot about the 86th running of the Toyota of the 24 Hours of Le Mans. How fitting that slip of the tongue, because it is the Toyota 86. That's right, Toyota wins, the curse is over, and it wasn't really close, was it? But there's still a lot of stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about a absolute beat 'em down that turned out to be a lie. Everything you saw was a lie in LMP2. We'll get into that. We'll talk about hashtag Smokey Bacon in the GTE classes and a McDreamy victory in GTAM as Patrick Dempsey fields the winning car in the Pro-Am GT category. And we'll also have plenty to say about the maximum stint lengths, BOP changes, equivalence of technology, silly penalties, crumbling LMP1 privateer challenges, and of course, some guy who's very good. We're here. He's now two-thirds of a way to some sort of prize called the Triple Crown. We'll talk about that, and we'll dive into some racer metrics as well. In the meantime, because I'm not very good at this part of the podcast, but this is where we get to plug all the places where you can find listen to, enjoy Motorsport 101 and all of its content, no better place than motorsport101.com. That's right, it's motorsport101.com. This is where you can find every episode of both this show and the Bike Live podcast. And if you subscribe to us on patreon.com/motorsport101, $5 gets you early access to every episode of this and Bike Live, where we're going to talk about the Catalan Grand Prix at MotoGP. So Dre will be back for that to talk about. Jorge Lorenzo's back.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. He announced he's leaving Ducati, and he's like, I want to be good now.
And Mark Marquez is going to say something really cryptic and weird about how he feels Ducati is celebrating the difference in victories.
Yes, we will get into all of that on our next episode of Bike Live. Again, $5 gets you early access to that show and to this episode, which if you have early access, you're probably listening to it right now and just pointing out all the inconsistencies in the editing. Of course, you can find us on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, twitter.com/motorsport_101. And if you want to follow us personally, we are at Harrison101HD. We are at Ryan Eric King. That's with two Ks. We are at RJ O'Connell. That's with two Ns and two Ls. And we are at PartyPat116. Now, it's time. It's time to crack open the Grand Prix d'Endurance, the 86 running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, after this quick musical interlude. It's Motorsport 101 After Dark, and that means it's time to race into the sunset. That's right, the 33-year curse is over. It's finally happened. Yeto, Toyota won the big one.
They did it. They really did it.
They did it.
They finally did it.
No more reminiscing of the gearbox breaking under the late great Jeff Krosnoff in 1994. No more anguishing over Ukio Katayama blowing a tire on the run through Indianapolis in 99. No more nightmares about Anthony Davidson flipping and breaking his back in 2012. No more awful memories of the Loom wire fire in 2014. And of course, you can just bury all those terrible, terrible memories of the last lap breakdown in 2016. They did it. They finally did it. We kind of knew they were going to do it, but they did it anyway, and that's still a pretty damn good thing. There's a lot to unpack here, folks. There is a lot to unpack. Because it felt like this was coming. It's not Toyota's fault that, you know, Volkswagen cheated their emissions test and had to make Audi and subsequently Porsche leave in back-to-back seasons. It's not their fault that budgets escalated too high for this this new LMP1 hybrid regulation set that Peugeot screamed and clamored for, and then as soon as it got put into place, they were just like, well, bye.
Peace.
It's not Toyota's fault that a lot of the privateers that we saw were very much hamstrung from the get-go, even before we got to Le Mans, whether that be the financial problems at Manor or the wrecked car at Dragon Speed or at SMP Racing at Spa. Yes, it was somewhat of a gimme victory, but there is still a lot of genuine, real accomplishment to what Toyota did. After so many close calls, they finally did the damn thing.
Yeah, King? No, go ahead.
King, how do you feel about this? We live in a world where the Chicago Cubs have won the World Series and Toyota has won Le Mans.
Man, it it felt inevitable that it was going to be this year, but again, anything could have happened. Man, Rafa Nadal was, you know, start of the race, so you don't know. That bad luck could have rubbed off on the Toyotas, but they were able to bring it home.
Tennessee,
our good tennis boy.
Yeah.
Right. So a lot of the attention around this race centered around one of the drivers in the number 8 car, who it turns out is still a really good racing driver, and for all of the very, very unhealthy hype that centered around him and only him throughout the entire race meeting, as it turns out, Fernando Alonso is still really good at this driving thing. Because we didn't expect him. I didn't expect him, honestly. And this is coming from, you know, the day one Alonso stan of the podcast. But as it turns out, you know, I was expecting him to really carry this team because I knew that he had two very capable drivers in Kazuki Nakajima, who, let's lay it out there, he took the pole. And Alonso will tell you that Kazuki Nakajima did put that number 8 Toyota on pole position.
Mm-hmm.
And I was expecting, you know, this is only Alonso's third sports car endurance race. It's only his second 24 hours. He wasn't that impressive at the Rolex 24 in LMP2 category competition. And I was kind of thinking Alonso will do well, but, you know, he's not going to really, like, explode out in the scene. And then the overnight hours of the race hit. Alonso got in the car overnight and then just kind of, you know, did his thing.
His overnight session is one of the coolest sessions I've ever seen at night. And even though it kind of struck me, I think about this now, of Lando Norris's overnight session at the Daytona this year when he was just in the wet on slicks, seconds a lap faster than anyone else on wets. Like, it was some special stints from Fernando, and really he got it. He was definitely had the hang of getting through traffic in the night. Also, I find it odd that you did not mention the recent Toyota failure that I actually found to be the most painful, which was how brutal an early 2017 happened.
Oh god, yep. I forgot all about that. Dude. Yeah, it was just like, goodness. At some point, they had two cars that were still in the front for victory, and then they had none.
It was in the span of an hour.
Right. It was in the span of an hour. And, you know, bless you, Vince Capelaire. I'm glad you were able to live that down. So, we're going to consult the first of our hashtag racer metric section here. Based on the 40 fastest race laps, and this was actually compiled by one of the drivers in this race, David Heinermeier Hansson. Turns out Fernando Alonso, his fastest 40 racing laps were the fastest of any other driver by about 0.4 seconds. David himself says to put Alonso's achievement of topping this chart by 0.4 seconds in perspective, in 2017, 16, and 15, the top driver in LMP1 would claim their position on this measure by less than 0.1 seconds.
He's real quick.
Yeah. As it turns out, some, maybe not all, but some of this attention is kind of justified.
I don't know if it's justified to be, yeah, Alonso is that good, but he's one of six drivers. I mean, yeah, one of six drivers racing for Toyota.
Yeah, and this also, you know, it doesn't do justice to the fact that Jose Ramiro Lopez in the 7 car was putting in some absolute hero stints and for a while genuinely had that number 7 Toyota up at front of the field. And we'll talk about how their race unfolded briefly. So we did cover that Fernando Alonso is a really good racing driver. He brought a lot of hype, a lot of it unhealthy, though some of it justified. But I do like that at the end, it was Kazuki Nakajima who had to sit in the car hopelessly as it crawled to a stop, and that Porsche rolled past him in 2016. This time it's Nakajima who takes the win, Avenging 2016 alongside Sebastian Buemi, who avenged that 2016 loss. Pour one out for Anthony Davidson. I know he probably he worked so hard to be a part of that victory, and the team will admit that, hey, this is as much his victory as well, because Davidson was, of course, the person who was asked to step aside for one Fernando Alonso. I think it was really cool to see Kazuki Nakajima take the checker flag for that race, because Lord knows, for whatever cynicism you feel about the way that Toyota were lined up to win this race, I don't know if you can begrudge Kazuki Nakajima at all for all that he's been through just in a short time in this race, having wins escape him in 2014 and 16 and 17.
Yeah. Here's the thing. I feel like we've gotten, but I feel like we've overlooked again, like in the ways we did when Audi had like a flawless year when against almost no competition, is that surviving the 24 hours has actually been the harder part of winning this race for Toyota than outright pace. I feel like we're diminishing their accomplishment in a lot of ways by saying, oh, the privateers weren't up there. Well, yeah, because they were a bunch of pumped up LMP2 cars. Yeah, I got feelings. Uh-oh. I got feelings about how people are writing off Toyota.
Oh boy. Oh, Patrick, just lay it on us. Bring those hot takes right to the oven.
Full disclosure. In 2016, after the failure that was, I went on a press trip to the Nürburgring that was by TMG. So I then got to see the factory, meet everyone involved with this victory today. I have talked to the driver several times. I consider their marketing director a friend. Anyways, that being said, how many Audi wins out of their many were against no real competition? There were the Bentley Speed 8 wins against no real competition. Like, this comes around every now and then where the top car is so obvious by a mile that no one's going to touch them unless reliability strikes. But then again,
Corvette Racing in some of the later GT1 classes, like, they were pretty much the only contenders, and nobody holds those successes against no competition against them. Nobody holds those empty class victories against Audi.
And but for kind some to, reason, kind to also bring it full circle back to the preview of the show, remember my comparison? The Dream Team had no competition.
Oh, yes. Now, granted, the Dream Team was different in that the USA suddenly got to stockpile all the talent in the world from the NBA, which they couldn't do before. This time, Toyota had all the talent on the shelf, but all of a sudden, Porsche and Audi weren't there anymore. Like, I look at these driver lineups up and down on paper, I'm thinking the Rebellion cars probably got the best chance on paper if you just look at their personnel, but it was clear that even matching them was going to be a stretch just by the way the first handful of laps broke down.
Those first couple laps were, I imagine, a bit demoralizing for a couple people in that paddock. Including, I think, no start to the race more demoralizing than Jensen Button's, who didn't even get to really start the race on time, thanks to an issue with that SMP car. And in all honesty, it only got worse for SMP from there.
Right. So as nightfall fell, Matevo Sazakian, whose last name I can never get right, and I apologize, but because Matevos is a good kid, but he spun it in the Porsche curves and backed it into the tire wall, and bless him, he tried so hard to fix the car by itself. It was shades of Satoshi Motoyama in 2012 with the Delta Wing. He was out there trying to rip the back panel off the car himself. He had the phone attached to his helmet trying to get this thing free, and nope, that 17 car just would not go. Eventually, Jensen Button and the number 11 car did start the race, albeit now an hour down, and bless them, they almost got to the end until they broke down in the final hour of the race. Whew. So there goes one
they
potential
seemed like
challenger,
they had
perhaps
the
strongest challenger
of the
non-rebellions.
Even with, by the way, everyone owes it to themselves to look up the GIF or the video of the SMP finally failing after the rear deck lid comes off. Those sparks are the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Oh man.
Things just get more depressing as you go down by the hour. We talked about depressing efforts. Bicol's racing, it almost looked like they weren't going to start. Bless them, they finally got the car off the grid, and the car did not catch fire under its own power. It did eventually catch fire when Dominic Kreihammer got punted off and wrecked on the last sector of the course. The car did catch a little bit of fire, and it was eventually written off. Bye. So there goes another hard luck challenger.
Bye, Coles.
Probably the surprise of the race was Dragon Speed, because they essentially had to rebuild their car after the Fittipaldi crash. And their race ended just after sunrise, I believe. I did not get to see what happened. I just know they were there in the race, hanging around one day, and then they were gone.
That's like, yeah. I feel there were a couple cars that just disappeared in the night without any real fanfare.
Yeah, that's... I don't know. It felt like... I wasn't expecting more of a challenge. I just felt that more cars would be a part of a weaker challenge.
Yeah, it
was in hour 17. It was Ben Hanley who was one of the quicker drivers in the qualifying sessions when that car, Ben Hanley, spun and hit the wall with the Porsche curves. We're going to see this come up a lot. So that's the Dragon Speed BR1 out of the way. The two Manor Ginettas, we don't know much about them, but they're definitely in trouble, and they were kind of in trouble throughout most of the race, but to their credit, they got one of them to the finish, which is not bad for a team that literally had to skip Spa and looked like they were about to get lapped by LMP2 cars early on in qualifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For a team that put that much pride, I feel very bad for them. Because I know a lot of that is not up to your boys, Patrick, Graham Lauten, John Booth. And it's not on the drivers, and it's not on Ginetta, who built a really nice-looking car, but it just was not meant to be for them this year.
No, but the fact that they were able to basically make it at all after what happened at the very start of the season, where Ginetta and their suppliers were withholding parts for... Keeping Manor down is a for next year in some capacity.
Right. It was this race gave us a very good quote, because it was Charles Robertson, Leo Russell, and Michael Simpson in the number 5 car. They were effectively 5th out of the 5 LMP1 finishers. But Mike Simpson gave us a very good quote. The chassis is phenomenal. I've been quicker than the likes of Fernando Alonso through the Porsche curves all day, and I'm a bloke from Hull with 2 kids. That shouldn't really be possible. Yes, indeed. But it is. It's back to Toyota. It's back to Toyota because we mentioned the 7 car was in contention for the win, but things got weird in the last couple of hours for them, because Kamui Kobayashi said that he forgot to came in on one of the final stops of his 11-lap stint. Maximum stint lengths is going to be something we'll talk about on this podcast, and not necessarily in the glowing light, but he went out one lap too long, which meant that he had to crawl around with no fuel in the car for like a whole lap, and then they got slapped with 2 separate penalties, which essentially served the same purpose. One for, I believe it was, violating the maximum stint late, and then another one for doing the same thing again.
Well, did they not get... I mean, both Toyotas at some point during the race were also hit with a 1-minute stop-goes for speeding in slow zones, because apparently, like, Buemi and everyone was just allergic to seeing slow zones.
Yeah, and credit to Eduardo Freitas for just cracking down on that shit early on. Yeah, there was also some minor controversy in the final 3 hours of the race when the number 8 Toyota got dropped while the wheels were spinning off of its jacks, but they kind of let it slide because, one, who was going to touch them, and two, there's a loophole where apparently it's all right if it's the electric motor and a clutch problem that kicks them off.
They weren't going to check too hard to see if it actually was a clutch problem, were they? Also,
no,
insert the, I've already seen a crazy conspiracy that Kamui threw the number 7 victory on purpose. You know.
I don't buy
it. No, that. Anyone that knows anything about Kamui Kobayashi knows he would refuse to do that.
Right. I take Kobayashi's word that he and Conway and Lopez did a very good job at this race. They just, as sad as it is to say, they just couldn't match the A car on the team. By the way, it's very weird that, because I got the car number switched around, and I'm thinking, like, that Nakajima Buemi Alonso car really should be number 7, shouldn't it? Shouldn't it? It just feels right. It sounds
felt like
right
it should have
head.
Been the 7 that won. After the past couple, I felt weird about the 8 being the prime car of this race, too. After 12 hours of reliability, I finally felt safe enough to go stand up, take a quick shower, refresher in the middle of the race. So I was watching as much as I could. And then I put on my Toyota Gazoo Racing shirt. And I was like, well, if anything happens in the back 12 hours of this race, it was definitely me and definitely my fault because I loved and hoped too much. But I think that shirt's safe. I think I can mark that down as a safe race shirt to wear. Unlike anything McLaren I own.
Oh, goodness. So yes, at the overall podium, it's the number 8 Toyota TS050 hybrid of Buemi, Nakajima, and Alonso, winning with 388 laps on the board. They were 9 or 10 laps short of the all-time distance record set in 2010 by Audi. The number 7 Toyota of Conway, Kobayashi, and Lopez, finishing 2 laps down with 386 laps posted. And the number 3 Rebellion Racing, and this is a bit of a surprise, but good to see two young drivers, Thomas Laurent and America's Gustavo Menezes, along with Matthias Bescha, very solidly understated veteran driver. They were 12 laps down, but they were on the overall podium with 376 posted. And to their credit, outlasted the more experienced trio of Senna, Lauder, and Yanni in the number 1 car.
Was weird that the ghost of Ayrton Senna was that far behind.
Man, I honestly feel, and I know, Patrick, I know you feel like the Rebellions wouldn't have stood a chance. I feel like a lineup of Senna, Lauder, and Yanni, you put them in a Porsche, they easily could have given the Toyotas a run for the money. But we'll never know in this post-Dieselgate, post-recession, post-LMP1 hybrid bubble burst era that we live in. I just want to point out, if you take all the Toyota drivers out of the equation, you know who had the fastest top 40 race laps average? America's Gustavo Menezes. And who said Americans aren't good at turning right in race cars and aren't ready for Formula One? I'm so proud of Gustavo, by the way. He basically bossed it in LMP2 in 2016. I was very proud of him that day, and I'm very proud of his performance getting on the overall podium. Man, Thomas Laurent was an absolute beast under the circumstances. They always have their stuff together, and I feel like with a little bit more budget behind them and probably a little quicker car, I think it would be a lot closer at least. We'll see what happens by this time next year. We'll see what happens over the next few WEC races. But, you know, if you're a fan of very close competition to LMP1, this may not be the season for you. And this may not have been the race for you. And that's fine. Because, the other classes? Man, they were very close and competitive. Especially after some amendments. So, what you thought you saw from the get-go after 8xSport took pole position in their Michelin-clad Orca 07 was an absolute all-time beat 'em down by G-Drive Racing, by TDS Racing. Andrea Pizzatola, the amateur driver who's not really an amateur, Roman Rusinov, the pro driver who's not really a pro driver, and one Formula E championship leader, Jean-Eric Verne, just took turns molly-whopping that field. I mean, goodness. They were by far and away through the first couple hours of the race. Yeah, I don't think anybody was going to touch them. They had a they completed 369 laps. They were set to win this class by... There we go. Would have won the class by two laps. Jean-Eric Verne was an absolute monster throughout the day. Just quick stint after marathon stint all day long. It looked like this was going to be the year of Jean-Eric Verne and him doing the Le Mans Formula E double. So fast forward to Monday afternoon. And, oh, goodness. Turns out there was a fueling rig irregularity. Fueling rig irregularity. The G-Drive drivers, the G-Drive team was able to fuel their cars faster than their competitors by a margin of about 6 to 8 seconds. You could put all that extra fuel in the car. They basically pulled a Benetton in 1994. And the stewards decided that that's not within the regulations, that's not kosher, and they, along with the number 28 TDS Racing Orca, were thrown out. So everything you just saw from Verne and Pizzatola and Roman Rusinov, that was a lie. Didn't happen. You were lied to this whole time.
Damn. I was... Man, that...
And all snark aside, that's gutting for Jean-Eric Verne, considering how he put that team on his back. I know he didn't do anything wrong. Andrea Pizzatola didn't do anything wrong. Roman Rusinov, I don't know, because he's been a part of two teams that now have been thrown out of the Elipu two standings in a span of 6 years. And some more hardened sports car listeners who listen to this podcast might remember 2015 at Fuji, where basically his team did the dump and run to win the LMP2 title at the expense of KCMG Racing.
Yeah.
Which, that went over like a fart in a church, to say the least. But out of all that, we still got a pretty good winner, the SigmaTech Alpine team, winning for the second time in 3 years. And the common thread with both of those, Nicolas Lapierre, another ex-Toyota guy, but you know what? It was only very fitting that he got to take the victory. This is his third LMP2 class win in the last 4 years. He won in 2015 with KCMG, 2016 with Alpine, and 2018 with Alpine again. And he's had three different sets of teammates every time. This time, it was former GP2 driver and Indy Lights driver Andre Negrau and Pierre Thirier, who was a true gentleman driver and a pretty quick one at that.
So quick, so good. Deserves it so much.
Yeah, I think it was very fitting that, you know, Lapierre was one of the guys who helped Toyota get back off the ground in LMP1 when they launched back in 2012. Got pushed out of the team. It happens sometimes, but he's made an absolute killing in LMP2. And goodness gracious, he's done so very well at this. We also need to bring up the fact that as all the aforementioned LMP1 privateers were getting picked off, there was a chance, we were talking about it, didn't ultimately happen, that the LMP2 cars could get back onto the overall podium as they did last year.
That would have been it's so funny. And also such a brutal indictment of how terrible these LMP1 privateers are in comparison to cars that are better developed and also, you know, better funded.
Also, can we also talk about the fact that, you know, Tristan Gomendy, who is hooked up to a very questionable part-time Indy 500 drive, as it turns out, he had a pretty good fallback by finishing second in class with Graf SO24 Racing in their Orca. And while the Orcas did have an advantage, we did get, out of all the disqualifications, a Leger on the class podium. And folks, there is only one, Pablo Montoya, along with Hugo de Sadler and Will Wowen. That's right, Montoya on the podium in his first Le Mans. It wasn't without drama. Montoya himself had a crash, and he admitted that he kind of ran out of talent. They had some dramas late in the race, but hey, they stuck with it. Seventh overall, third in class. Do you kind of think that maybe Montoya beats Alonso to the Triple Crown? Maybe?
Or you don't know if Alonso takes a bit too long to move to get his Indianapolis win. We could see maybe Acura, you know, entering the whatever hypercar class it is, and if Montoya's still around, he'll probably get a ride with Penske.
Well, here's the thing. Montoya is not too far removed from a test with Porsche back when their LMP run program was still going.
That's true.
The only thing I think he has going against him, I don't think it's his fitness, and I don't think it's his speed, is, you know, would any aspiring manufacturer team take a chance on a driver who is going to be in his mid-40s by the time that opportunity rolls around? Can we also give props as well to Team Malaysia? Sarah Sahaden, we love you very much, and we're so proud of your guys, Jasmine Jafar, Nabil Jeffrey, and Weiron Tan, for finishing fourth in class, and Pastor Maldonado, ninth overall with Roberto Gonzalez and Nathaniel Berthon at Dragon Speed. Ninth overall and fifth in class. That's very good.
Yeah, that's very good. Tremendous performance.
Oh, yes. So everything you saw in LMP2 was alive. Well, not all of it, but, you know, we got some good material out of it.
2/3 of the podium was a lie, statistically.
No, just 1/3, because TDS Racing, they got close. Loic Duval was trying his best, but just couldn't catch him. And oh goodness, poor Loic Duval. He was fastest on this chart that David Heinemeier Hansen put up. He was fastest by 0.8 seconds over John Eric Verne. Loic Duval was content to win this race by his damn self if he needed to. He's a former overall winner of this.
Yeah, he's real good. I like Loic.
Very, very good. I'm shocked to see Ricky Taylor as far down at this list. By the way, it's at DHH Racing if you want to see these lap charts. And also, thanks as well to the Bill B Pillar. That's at the B Pillar on Twitter. A lot of fun infographics where, in a race that's kind of hard to track, sometimes it's fun to look at it through infographics and spreadsheets.
Maybe
like
a little
this.
Bit, yeah.
This actually makes endurance racing a lot more engaging for me on a personal level. And it's also fun to kind of do my own projects with this as well. I know we kind of do that with Super GT.
And the giant
M8. Reminds me, I've still got to do that for Suzuka. I probably said that in an episode weeks ago.
Yeah, I think you did. Yeah.
So let's mosey on down and avoid my responsibilities by diving into the saga of hashtag Smokey Bacon. GTE Pro promised a good show. It did not disappoint, especially if you were a Porsche fan who has fond nostalgia of days gone by. That's right, the pink pig livery from the 70s, it's back. The Roth... No, we can't call it the Rothmans livery. It's it's the Rothman-esque livery. It's back. And they finish 1-2. Pink Pig ahead of the Rothman's car. Bacon ahead of Smokey. That would be Kevin Estra, Michael Christensen, and Lawrence Vanthoor, despite the complete demolishment and ruination of the Porsche curves, by which his car is named, somehow managed to survive and persevere and win the race ahead of the Rothman-esque car, Smokey, as it's been effectually nicknamed, of Frederick McAfee, Jimmy Bruni, who shattered the class record in qualifying, and Richard Leitz. I tell you what, they were pretty much in a class of their own all race, weren't they? Goodness, they had a race all to themselves for like 24 hours, it seemed, apart from some ebbs and flows here and there where some other cars got involved, but it was pretty much them for from start to finish.
Yeah, I it's no secret I was vocal about preferring the Rothman-esque car.
I did too. I said in the preview that, you know, if it were down the looks, they should have won this by 20 laps.
Thank you. I'm kind of bummed that Core also didn't. There are enough classic Porsche liveries to. You could have thrown at least one more. Done the hippie Porsche. Done the hippie 917. That would have been perfect.
Do a classic Brumos livery while we're at it.
One livery.
Oh.
That car is basically a GT1 car, anyways.
oh goodness! Oh. And it's a loud boy. So while we had Porsche celebrating a 1-2 victory with their heritage livery cars, entered from the European side of the operation, the American side of the operation did not fare as well as both the 93 and 94 Porsches with their very standard and drab run-of-the-mill Porsche liveries. Both broke down and failed.
The new corporate livery is good. Don't at me.
I think it's fine. It's not as terrible as everyone makes it out to be. It's just fine.
Chevrons, RJ. It's got chevrons. Come on.
I actually get my gas at Sunoco, but thank you. And IndyCar. Let us not forget, and that might be a good time to pivot to the fact that Ford had three IndyCar drivers and probably the best chance of toppling Porsche, but despite some good performances from the likes of Dirk Moeller, Andy Prio, Harry Tignall, and Sebastian Bourdais, who, by the way, was very unimpressed with Super GT's superstar alumnus Frederick McAfee, after pulling off an audacious pass on almost over the track limits. And then Bourdais basically implied that if it wasn't for him sharing a car with two other teammates, he would have put McAfee in the wall.
Bourdais quote, if I've ever heard one.
Oh, he was especially salty. He was salty about balance of performance, which, you know, Ford got a good break on BOP one, so how dare they ever allow to be complained about anything ever. Oh, by the way, we're going to give Aston Martin another performance buff, and it's still not going
to
be
enough. Yeah, here's the thing. No, Ford's not allowed to talk about BOP ever because of how much they lied. That car's fine now. They were... even though we should be mad at BMW for doing the same exact thing in a way, because, hey, guess how many M8s have been sold? Zero. Guess how many will be sold the next 12 months? Probably zero. It's not a real car yet. Not a real car yet.
But they hashtag do it the right way. BMW were also present surprised in the fact that they were genuinely quick. Like, the 81 car probably had a chance at an overall at a class podium, and then they kind of blew it. But they still showed the pace, which Aston Martin with the new, very good-looking, but very slow Aston Martin Vantage just didn't get together. Darren Turner said as much. It's not a BOP thing. The car is just set up poorly, and they haven't got the setups right at all.
Well, first year at Le Mans goes, unless you are Ford or BMW.
And the thing is, like Darren Turner said, of course the car's not comfortable. If it were comfortable, we'd be really worried.
Yeah.
So the Fords get the last spot on the podium. That was the 68 of Han, Muller, and Bourdais, team that won it in 2016. Corvette and Ferrari, they were thereabouts. They had a solid race. They didn't make any mistakes. The 63 car was decently quick for what is now a 5-year-old car, and they just couldn't kind of move anywhere. A lot of this had to do with maximum stint lengths. I believe it was 14 laps or 15 laps you do at a time.
Yeah, it was 14 laps.
14 laps you could do at a time, and this was all to try and put the performance not in the hands of the strategists, but in the hands of the individual drivers who are all evenly matched. And with the cars evenly matched, it all makes the drivers, it all puts it in the hands of the drivers and equalize the car's performance and equalize the strategy. Except once everybody kind of found a position, they just kind of stayed there. Which is...
They sure balance the performance.
Because... Yeah,
they balance the scales by making sure they don't move.
Yeah, because if you have everyone doing 14 laps, like, stints, you just have, you know, a series of 14-lap sprint races for the over 24 hours.
And we always joke about, haha, Le Mans is a registered trademark 24-hour sprint race, but you break this down and do 14-lap sprints, it didn't really produce good racing. Not to say that the on-track action was not good, but we would have liked to see, like, Corvette's main game is that, you know, they could go off-strategy and pull some miracles at times where they didn't necessarily have the fastest car because of strategy. Lena Gade, who was an absolute delight on Radio Le Mans as a last-minute addition to the commentary team. And by the way, I very much appreciate all the post-layoff saltiness she was bringing to the table.
What a lovely, delightful woman she is. Oh, she's the best.
A lovely, delightful, 3-time Le Mans winning engineer. Who was very, very upset at how the strategy was playing out, especially in the later parts of the race. But she did not pull any punches. Shoutouts as well to the entire RSL team. They did a fantastic job covering the race and everything leading up to it. And, you know, as independent broadcasters, they were going to be brutally honest. And, you know, there were times where I thought John Hindau was going to literally spontaneously combust in the booth. From all of the weird shit that was happening in this race.
That sounds like him. He had some rough takes this race, I felt like, but you know, that's the thing that's gonna happen over time. It's 2018.
I feel like it almost makes you, I kind of feel like, and I know there are some situations obviously where even all the equalization could not have, you know, made things even. Look at LMP1, for instance. But I do kind of feel like by trying to make everything more equal, by just over-regulating everything, they've made it less equal. And the thing is, like, a lot of the problem is the fact that with a lot of the ACO's decision-makings with equivalence of technology, you know, why are the Toyotas effectively mandated to be a half-second faster than everybody else? You know, why are you making late BOP changes the day after qualifying and the day before the race? Every bit of that could have been explained in a more transparent manner, and maybe we kind of wouldn't have this deeply sown distrust in everything the WEC and the ACO have done over the past several weeks.
Yeah, because...
I mean, King, is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. Like, it felt like there was a lot of puppeteering behind curtains, like, where... sort of put in a position where you kind of can't 100% trust the ACO to be, you know, a fair arbiter of regulations.
Are you telling decisions that made things, one, worse, and two... maybe weren't above board? Are you trying to tell me that about those storied French organizations? How dare you?
Yes. Because, again, the 14-lap maximum stint, it makes it seem equal on paper, but again, it creates a situation where whoever could do a 14-lap stint the fastest is gonna be your winner, and you end up in a situation where, you know, maybe the privateer LMP1s could have been better off if they could run longer stints. We'll never know.
But we'll never know because they had maximum stint lengths posed on them from the beginning.
Yeah.
And delta times that they had to meet and not exceed from the beginning.
And I'm like, what is this? GT3 24-hour racing? Like,
yeah, that was a point that was made as well, is that, you know, some things at Spa the Spa 24 have gotten kind of sketchy. Can we also point out the fact that both Tony Kanaan and Scott Dixon got their teams penalized for not meeting the minimum overall drive time? I know you're both used to short form racing, but my dudes, you could do a little bit more. Scott Dixon could do a lot more.
Have they put out statements saying what happened with that?
Not that I could find.
What? Okay, because that means it's the embarrassing we didn't do the math right one.
Tony Kanaan only drove 5 hours and 16 minutes, and I believe it was Scott Dixon, as I'm doing my real-time research. Dixon.
12 minutes. Three laps.
Guys, he got so used to the really short stints on American Ninja Warrior that he just couldn't do it.
No, Dixon did 83 laps, but okay. The thing is, you had to do at least 6 hours of the race. Didn't quite get there.
Tony Kanaan couldn't do 45 extra minutes.
I mean,
just pretend you're at Texas. Come on, bud. You can just float through it.
But I think the interesting angle to all of this is the fact that, you know, the Porsche dominance didn't stop in the pro category, because in GTM, dare I say, things were McDreamy at the top step. No, we didn't get the chance to see Patrick Dempsey win his class at Le Mans as a driver, but his team, Dempsey Proton Racing, did win it, and that's sufficient. That's very sufficient, I feel.
Yeah.
Matt Campbell, Julian Adlauer, and Christian Reed taking the victory in the number 77 car. Which, by the way, Matt Campbell, Julian Adlauer, two very good young drivers. I feel like Campbell and Adlauer especially, who's only 18 years old, and a very generous silver-rated driver, if only because he's young and somewhat unproven. I feel like they're going to be studs for a long time. Especially Campbell. My goodness. He got a chance to be Shane Van Gisbergen's co-driver at the Bathurst 1000 last year. I think he's going to get a similar chance, and I think he's going to just show, like, hey, I could actually hang with the big boys that are around full-time if I don't decide to pursue this Porsche deal.
Good day when a fellow Patrick wins something in motorsport vicariously. Yeah.
Hey.
Also, that photo of Dempsey is a screaming on the pit wall is also very good, and shows how much he still, even though he's not driving anymore, it shows how much his heart really is still.
He cares about this sport. He cares about this. There's no acting. I think, like, if it in a behind Paul Newman, of course, Dempsey's probably the solid second best actor turned racing driver there's ever been.
I'm sorry, tell that to Frankie Muniz.
I'm sorry, how many Le Mans podiums has Frankie Muniz been
overall
a part of lately?
Don't fact check that. Trust me.
Yes, second in class was the 54 Spirit of Race Ferrari, Thomas Flohr, Francesco Castellacci, and Giancarlo Fisichella fastest of the drivers in this Pro-Am category, and by a considerable margin. Yeah.
Noted DJ. Oh, no, no, no.
Shit, really?
At the Lone Star Le Mans 2 years ago. No, that's what he did in between those couple years when he, after he replaced Felipe in 09, and then before going back to sports cars. No, he was a full-time DJ for a while. He still DJs. He's apparently very good.
I can't believe Raul Boisel DJs well into his 50s and 60s.
Isn't that what Jaime Alguersuari is doing right now?
That's what I would do if I was him.
I hope they're all... I hope they're all living their best lives now. Because Raul Boisel, in addition to being an accomplished DJ, is also an accomplished short host jumper. That's one for you mid to early 90s kart fans out there. And the 85 Katie Motorsports car, that's effectively Risi Competizione under a different name, dedicating Jerome Bligamo and Lucas Stoltz, had a chance to topple the Porsche hierarchy in GT-AM, but Ben Keating kind of beached it. I know, Patrick, it's hard to accept that, you know, a Texas businessman would, and a Texas A&M graduate, Ben Keating, would chuck it away like this.
He's actually, I am shocked that he would bin it like that, because he's usually actually quite handy.
Yeah, he's very good at this. Just, you know, stuff like that happens. He kind of lost in the wet conditions, and... You know,
he's lost now that they stopped making the Viper.
All I'm going to say is I'm glad that they've at least put out a concept, and it might be back soon, and maybe with an engine that makes more sense in this day and age, and it's still going to look nice. Please.
I'm going to be that person. It's not the Viper without a V10. The worst V10. A terrible V10.
I'm just convinced you're never going to be a fan of the Dodge Viper, no matter what kind of engine they put in it.
Very fast, but bad.
We can never be friends. Listen, some garbage is acceptable, and that's all I will say on the matter.
You mean the ACO's rules for the 24? Har har har.
Har har har. Yeah, this
acceptable
might be
garbage.
Yeah, that's we've already covered it at length, but I was just sitting at a point, you know, that I kind of feel like, you know, there's brilliance in simplicity, and I feel like, you know, the ACO still have time in between this year's Le Mans and next year's Le Mans to kind of sort out what went wrong this year. I don't expect drastic changes, because I know that's going to come with a new set of regulations that are proposed for 2020/2021, because we're getting hypercars now. That's going to be our new prototype class. That's going to be our new premiere. We're getting hypercars. We're getting LaFerraris and Aston Martin Valkyries and McLaren P1s and Toyota GR Supersports.
So DPI light.
Yeah, it's
a DPI
like,
hypercar,
DPI
if
hypercar.
You will.
DPI.
I don't know what it's going to be.
Oh shit, it's got.
Diaper car. Yeah.
Quite literally.
That might. Well, this. Is this a bad time to point out that the ACO is having like an open competition to name the new top class?
No. Why would you do that?
So even money.
How we had come up with hypercar McHypercar.
I was just about to say that's got even money. Even money on hypercar McHypercar face.
Oh Jesus.
So I've had a chance to look over the regulations. It seemed like they want to bring in a lot more. Manufacturers obviously want to bring some back, want to bring some new ones in the top class fold. They want to slash the budget by 1/4. They want to meet much more conservative lap times, target lap time of 3:20 around Le Mans, which is getting dangerously close to LMP2 times, but we'll just leave that to the side. They want to make the hybrid power more attainable for potential customer teams. So you have to sell it with a single hybrid powertrain. It all looks very good on paper. And, you know, ultimately the goal is still for the WEC and IMSA to create a common top class. out of all this, what do you see the future of the Premier class of Le Mans looking like? As I want to believe it's going to be good, because I feel like the top class definitely needs some reinvigoration. Will it meet all the expectations?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, so here's the rub. I think if they are going to be around 320, I think the year they are brand new and still kind of unreliable at Le Mans is the one year where the top class will be beaten by an LMP2 car, and it will be deeply embarrassing for the ACO.
I don't think anything will be as embarrassing as Daytona Prototype's debut race in 2003, where they let a GT2 class Porsche Cup car win the fucking thing at Daytona.
Well, I mean, that happened like 2 years ago at Petite.
I mean, granted, but that was in monsoon conditions. And
yeah, that was a nightmare.
There were nightmare conditions, and it was a lopsided tire war. They didn't have those excuses in 2003.
Yeah, and I'm also assuming if once the hypercar category becomes a thing, LMP2 won't be LMP2 anymore.
Yeah, this has always been like... But the thing is, like, what do you just scrap LMP2 and replace it with LMP3 so soon after you've devised this global LMP2 formula? See, the thing is, it's always a tricky puzzle catch. You get rid of LMP1, okay, now you have LMP2 as the top class with no manufacturers. So then you kind of have to scrap LMP2, and now it's all GTs. But where do you put the prototype runners? You put them in LMP3? Where they're going to be awkwardly as quick as the GT cars?
No, I think they're going to have to come up with a category between the hypercars and the GT cars, because it wouldn't be a good look if they get rid of the top class prototypes and still have prototypes on track.
No, yeah, so you need... I think the reality of what it's going to be is LMP2 gets renamed. LMP2 gets renamed, but it's... Because there's no way the IMSA teams will let... Hey, we spent all this money on these deep... quote-unquote, all this money on these DPI programs, and now we can't do anything with them at all.
And then in that case, you know, you make a compelling point, like, why wouldn't the ACO just adopt DPI as the new top class just because it isn't theirs?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that is a legit ACO thing to do.
The most ACO reaction, actually. You made this? I made this.
I don't know. I don't know. I think, out of all this, though, I think there's still a lot of enjoyment that we had. Was the best meme of the 24 Hours of Le Mans the screen caps of all the mechanics lying asleep on the floor and in their chairs at random points of the race, or was it photoshops of the BMW M8 looking like a macro-sized giant car?
The M8 without a question.
I'm not going to lie. I saw it chasing down the three micro machine size 40 GTs and about laughed till I threw up.
Oh my god.
And I just started giggling uncontrollably, and it was the happiest a race car image had made me in a very long time.
Shoutouts to noted sim racer and GT world champion and deserved better than to be slow all race long Nicky Tim for sharing some of that stuff. In between stints in the car.
We kind of forgot to talk about it as much as I wanted to. It's real weird that Aston kind of got this vantage so wrong, right?
Yeah.
Like, it, I know the last vantage kind of started off slow. All of their sports cars kind of start off slow. Except, like, the DBR9.
Right, yeah, and I think, as we covered, it was mostly down to setups. Mm-hmm. I think they'll need to take time, and it just so happens that their next race just happens to be at home, just happens to be these 6 hours of Silverstone, which is now in the summertime, so it's not going to snow all goddamn weekend. Final thoughts on Le Mans. This was a race that brought a lot of feelings out of us even before it started. And we got the result that I think a lot of people were expecting, some were hoping for. I came away knowing that even though I kind of knew that Toyota were going to walk this, you know, nothing was a given. Absolutely nothing was a given during that race. And I feel like no matter how much everything seemed to be skewed in their favor, that's still a massive achievement from a manufacturer who was kind of owed something at Le Mans for times past. I know I would have loved to see them beat Audi and Porsche in a straight-up fight, but they did the best with what they could. I'm very proud of Alonso and Buemi and Nakajima for finally closing the deal and getting a win for Toyota. Like, that's massive no matter the circumstances.
Damn.
And I think everybody who finished that race has a lot to be proud of. Every team, every driver, every set of mechanics, they have something to be proud of. Le Mans has had lean years before. This is not necessarily a lean year because there was still a capacity grid and a good, healthy dose of competitive racing across the three lower categories. You know, maybe this is not an all-time classic, but you know, there's still something that's very special about this race. Even the casual observer, this race is still something that a lot of people recognize. It still means something to every team, every manufacturer, and every driver takes part. And I don't think that will ever go away, no matter how much politicking there is backstage. Because Lord knows you can't host a breakaway round of one of these.
We'll keep a car count, though.
Where would they host it?
We'll just put it on the Bugatti circuit.
Oh, my God. But, yeah. Yeah, this was certainly a Le Mans for the record books, but not the highlight reels. Le Mans is rarely ever one for the highlight reels, but it's always one for the record books.
Oh, yes. King, as the official candidate for FIA president, how would you rate the 86 running of the 24 Hours of Le Mans?
I feel like I'm rating it higher than a lot of other people. I want to say either leading towards 7, but I'm probably going to say 6.5 out of 10.
We're giving it 6.5. Toyota finally won the damn things out of 10.
Yes.
Pat, how are you feeling about this one?
I probably artificially high because I finally got to see my friends win. That felt good. I had low expectations for the level of challenge that Toyota was going to face, so I feel like I was never blinded by that at any degree. I would have liked to see Aston fight back better, but I feel like a 6.5 at 7 is probably where it's at, actually.
Yeah.
This one's tough. I feel like the result that it gave, I feel like for the sense of accomplishment that all the winning teams feel like, it's tough. I gotta go with like a I'll give it a solid 6 weird seizure inducing close-ups of the Ferris wheel at night that were caught on the TV mm-hmm. camera out of 10. Oh no, we're giving it 6 awkward Tom Christensen telestrator segments out of 10. Oh my God, I did not even see the audio for that, and I could just feel the cringe wash across me from across the screen as I was watching that.
It was real bad. I might get sugarcoated. It was real bad.
Damn it,
TK. You managed to make Mr. Le Mans look very awkward and out of place at Le Mans. How do you do that?
The man won Le Mans 407 times, and you're going to do that to him? You're going to do him dirty like that? At his home?
Was it him that was in the Fox shirt?
I believe so.
Somebody was in a Fox shirt.
Sorry, I just opened the photo of the BMW chasing the Fords again.
Please, please give it to me. Wait for it, wait for it, wait for it.
It's so good.
More sleep deprivation.
Oh, shit.
I'm trying not to laugh. I'm trying not to laugh. It's almost 11 p.m. as they're recording this. Now I know how Dre feels. Oh, goodness. What else did we miss? Red Bull's hooking up with Honda. Some people not named Martin Wishmarsh. What? Martin Wishmarsh. Okay, Martin Whitmarsh definitely does not want Martin Whitmarsh to come back into power at McLaren. It's all employees who are disgruntled and want Martin Whitmarsh to come back.
You know, the guy who sucked at running McLaren only slightly less than Ron Dennis sucked at running McLaren.
Hey, hey, those employees have fond memories of all those years that they were mediocre.
Ooh, let's not... They just broke a lot. They were real fast. They just broke a lot.
Yeah, they were real fast, yeah.
Look, I'll take that. I'll take that.
Yeah, I bet that's what they're thinking. We'll take that. We'd rather be fast and break down than not fast and breaking down like some of the time.
And that's how we got a Lewis Hamilton dynasty with some
so,
other team.
By the way, what's Red Bull's new name? How what do they compete as next year?
I don't know. Like I assume they'll have to like there's no way the relationship with Aston Martin can continue now.
So do you know what that deal was done in though, the title sponsorship deal? It was not cash. It was stock.
Stock. Ooh. God, dude.
That's why they're making the Valkyrie together. Mm. That is the Aston Martin Red Bull Valkyrie.
And like Aston Martin has been teasing that they're gonna, you know, this new hypercar class, Le Mans, they want to be involved, which I'm all for. If I'm FIA president, I'll try to BOP the shit out of that to get like Jamie Chadwick an overall victory.
Consider also though. Aston Martin might be hooking up with somebody else because guess who wants to get into Formula One and has been rumored as a potential buyer of all of Vijay Mallya's.
Oh,
yes.
RJ.
Or it could be that beleaguered Formula One team in Grove.
The potential buyer of Force India is Michael Andretti. Maybe. We don't know. But it sounds good. It sounds right. So I definitely want it to happen, which means it won't happen. But man, wouldn't that be cool?
Alexander Rossi, I mean, so 2019 World Drivers Champion.
But I want to know, why is Michael interested in Formula One again? Because a couple years ago, he pretty much said the only way he'd ever be involved in Formula One is if they'd allow customer cars. And they're not allowing customer cars.
Yeah. I mean, I did my huge follow the money rant when we first saw this reported a couple day night at McLaren, yeah. India, Sahara, but WT. The Force India story already.
Just scrape up all the money they can. Force India Part 2. Force America.
Eddie Jordan's buying the team. Force He's back America. In. Buzz, buzz.
Oh, good. No.
Oh, no, they got caught smuggling cocaine in the cars. Oh, no. Eddie. Come on, bud.
And on that bombshell, we've wrapped up our recap of the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and we'll soon be reinstating Andre Harrison to the podcast next week as we discuss the French Grand Prix that's happening this week. This coming week, the granddaddy of them all.
Hashtag granddaddy of them all.
Yep, we got Formula 1 and Formula 2 and GP3 at Paul Ricard. We've also got IndyCar and Indy Lights at Road Ooh. America. What else we got? DTM and F3 Europe at the Norris Ring, where we're hearing some reports about Class 1 and that hookup with GT500. And by the way, Super GT back in 2 weeks.
It's a good time to be. It's a.
Oh.
We've got what? We've got 7 Grand Prix in the next 7 weekends or something crazy?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. And there's a chance that half of them might be good.
Guys, what do we do if Paul Ricard's somehow a good racetrack? What do we do?
100-year contract for Paul Ricard.
The granddaddy of them all is back.
We officially call it the granddaddy of them all.
Isn't that the internal name for Chase Carey at Liberty Media? He wants a mustache ride. Come on.
I think on that bombshell,
I'm never getting invited back.
Things up. Remember, you can back us. You can back the show on patreon.com/motorsport101 for early access to Bike Live and to Motorsport 101. Of course, on this episode of Bike Live, we'll be talking all about MotoGP at Barcelona, the Catalan Grand Prix. Jorge Lorenzo, still very good. First time winners in Moto 3. Lots of tributes to the late, great Andrés Pérez. And a lot more to talk about on the show on Bike Live, which you can get early access by being a Patreon backer at the $5 level. For $10, you can even listen to the show as it's being recorded, which is really neat. You get to see all the mistakes as they are happening. But in all seriousness, though, thank you to everybody who backs us, and thank you to everybody who listens to us this week. Thank you so much. And you can find us at motorsport101.com. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, and Twitter at motorsport_101. Again, our personal handles at Harrison101HD. Dre will be back soon. At Ryan Eric King, at RJ O'Connell, at PartyPat116. Pat, places where we can find you and all the cool stuff that you do?
Nowhere right now, because I just started a full-time desk job that is not involved with motorsports in any way. But you should see things from me soon on motorsport101.com, even.
It's .com, folks. It's .com. We got the .com name during Day of Classics 3, the third one.
Yeah, I'll probably have some late thoughts on why Monaco is good, actually, and y'all are just mean.
yes. Places you can find myself, probably stretching over the Braves stretch run towards the postseason. That's really about it. Places where we can find you, King.
Yeah, just motorsport101.com and on Twitter at Ryan Eric King.
And at JC Penney.
And at JC Penney. You know, if you're ever at an appliance department in any JC Penney store, just tell them you want to call the store in New York, and they'll connect you right through.
That's right, folks. Ryan would have taken the FIA president's job, but he didn't want to take the pay cut.
Yeah. Come on, Andy Palmer. Fund my campaign.
So, for Patrick Hofstetter, for Ryan Eric King, and on behalf of Andre Harrison, who will be back with us very shortly, I'm RJ O'Connell. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Motorsport 101 podcast, and we'll catch you all next time. Sayonara.
Bye.
Goodbye.
You are the world champion!
But seriously, Andy Palmer, just wire me some cash. I'll run for FIA president when I'm president. I'm making sure that either Nicky Tim or Jamie Chadwick gets an overall victory at Le Mans. You have my word on it.
That's the FIA
absolutely.
Spirit.
I would absolutely
fixing things.
I'm also endorsing this if we can get Charlie Martin in there as well.
Yep. Come on.
Absolutely.
Come on, Aston.